WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Tatum, just get in the car.
Hello, Sydney.
Hi. Who is this?
You tell me.
Well, I have no idea.
Scary night, isn't it? With the murders and all, it's like right out of a horror movie or something.
Randy, you gave yourself away. Are you calling from work? Because Tatum's on her way over.
Do you like scary movies, Sydney?
I like that thing you're doing with your voice, Randy. It's sexy.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Oh, come on. You know I don't watch that shit.
Why not? Too scared?
No. No, it's just, what's the point? They're all the same. Some stupid killer stalking some big-breasted girl who can't act, who's always running up the stairs when she should be going out the front door. It's insulting.
Are you alone in the house?
Randy, that's so unoriginal. I'm disappointed in you.
Maybe that's because I'm not Randy.
So, who are you?
The question isn't, who am I? The question is, where am I?
So where are you?
Your front porch.
Well, that's how the Scream phenomenon started. Scream and its popular sequel, Scream 2, which opened in December, are horror films that also satirize the cliches of the genre. It seems to be a winning combination. Scream grossed $100 million in the U.S., and Scream 2 has already grossed $96. The director of both films, Wes Craven, has spent his career creating, subverting, and lampooning the rules of the horror genre. He made his name directing horror films such as A Nightmare on Elm Street, Vampire in Brooklyn, The Hills Have Eyes, and Last House on the Left. We called Wes Craven and asked him why he thinks Scream's hybrid of horror and satire works so well.
I think that the fact was that horror had reached one of its sort of classical, cyclical stages of ennui on the part of the audience. You know, it just had gone so far along the same lines that people were bored with it and kind of knew what to expect, and it kind of was in that place where it needed to be satirized, at least before you went on and did something new. You had to sort of acknowledge, this is where we've been, I know you're all bored, and I know you're thinking you know what's going to happen. So that became kind of the charm of it. In that sense, it's kind of a release, you know. It's like a joke about anything. There's kind of a rush of relief that it's being talked about, very frankly, you know. So in the sense that you say, we know horror films have been either boring or stupid or predictable, there's kind of a rush of relief because they know, well, at least they're in the presence of somebody who is smart enough to figure that much out. Now let's see if they can do something new.
Now tell me what you found most predictable. Your characters have some opinions on that. what's your opinions?
Well, you know, you could quote some of the characters. You know, the big-breasted girl who runs upstairs instead of out the front door when there's a threat, and you know, who always goes to investigate and you know, sort of does the stupid thing rather than the smart thing. The classic situation of the girl running away from the monster and always falling down. You know, there's all those cliches in horror films that you know, we wanted to avoid and also acknowledge or stand on their head. So I think it was a large part of that, just a sort of a stupidity, a sort of a built-in sexism quite often, a sense of gore for gore's sake, and also a very heavy emphasis on this sort of killer at the expense of any characterization of, you know, of the more normal people, if you will. And also a complete lack of recognition of the fact that these were events that were happening within the context of a society that had movies about these subjects. You know, people in the movies of this sort had never commented on the fact that they were in a situation very similar to movies that we all know and could easily talk about.
Right, and that they could use that knowledge to help them.
Exactly.
In the press kit for Scream 2, one of the producers is quoted as saying that she is awed by your ability to evoke terror from the actors you work with. She says, he can make an actor so terrified that you actually believe these things were happening to that person. What is she referring to?
Well, I don't know exactly. You'd have to ask her. I mean, you know, part of the job is to get that sense of the reality of situations when actors and actresses are surrounded by crew and cameras and not much is really happening, you know, in the actual physical space they're in. You know, try to remind them of things that they might have filmed 3 weeks before in a, you know, totally different environment that will cut immediately either to or from the moment they're in now. So you kind of, you know, you're kind of their ally in putting them into context of that sort of ephemeral thing, which is the movie that's going to be but is not right at the moment. You know, that's to me one of the biggest tricks of directing is just trying to make them see the movie that isn't done yet or, you know, has hardly begun.
Because they're just seeing the moment that they're shooting right now, and you want them to see what happened just before and what's about to happen.
Right, and what's happened to the character and you know, what it means personally and you know, what might have frightened her 10 minutes before in the movie that the actress might have completely forgotten about. I mean, and it's sometimes just, you know, in conversations with the actor or actress, for instance, a specific example would be working with Drew Barrymore when she first came on the location. She and I stayed up late one night and just talked about our lives. And from that, I learned a lot of personal things. Her extreme connection to animals, for instance, that I was able to use. So quite often when she was reacting to things that in the script were, like, say, somebody breaking a window and trying to get at her, it was she and I were talking about what was happening to a puppy in a news article about somebody who had tortured a dog. You know, so there's all sorts of tricks. You just try to find the sort of, you know, the commensurate place in their subconscious, in their real life, and connect it to the imaginary events in a way that's meaningful to them, and it's different for every single actor and actress.
Hmm. Wes Craven is my guest. I know when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, horror film meant usually a supernatural film, you know, Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman. You're one of the people who made the horror film more about teen anxieties and, you know, slashers who prey on teenagers. Sometimes those slashers are fellow teenagers. Sometimes they're more supernatural kind of figures, you know, like Freddy Krueger. So tell me a little bit about how you think the meaning of horror films became transformed.
Well, it's I think they're quite profound films. They are dealing with fear, which is certainly one of the primal emotions and one of the most immediate signals of danger and the necessity for taking action or else not surviving. You know, so you can't get much more basic than that. And they always sort of perceive, you know, what is sort of that subcutaneous, subconscious fear that's in the culture at the time. You know, there were lots of films in the 50s about, you know, the effects of atomic energy.
Mm-hmm.
There were early on films, I think, even at the dawning of science about, you know, the effects of science on human conduct, for instance, like Frankenstein, you know, where you have, it's all based on what can be done medically, you know, to this person and how that is either in control or not in control. And there was a long period of sort of psychosis as, you know, sort of the key element of fear because it seemed like there were so many things that had happened in society. I think even post-World War II, where you had culture coming out of the sort of, you know, coming out of shock of what they had just seen of an entire world at war and these sort of horrendous events being perpetrated by, you know, by the Nazis and in a sense by everybody that, you know, went to war against each other.
So Psycho would be a good example of that.
Psycho was a great example of that, and I wanted to mention that, you know, because that is a pure case of not a monster in the sense of a, you know, Godzilla or something, but it's a human monster. I think, you know, horror films like Godzilla and King Kong are kind of a relief in a way, because they are so removed from our reality. They're a little bit more of a popular entertainment, although I think in some ways that they speak also to a sort of a subconscious dread that we have botched nature so much or offended it so much that it's going to come back and get us and destroy our cities, you know, because we are, you know, such sort of a carbuncle on the skin of nature, you know. But certainly with Psycho, you had that idea of the crazy person being the wild card that we would have to deal with, even though we didn't want to, that it didn't fit into civilization at all, but simply was there in a significant way. And that continued on through, I think, the 70s, you know, where it was psychotic people like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, the rural family that had sort of gone back to some primeval state. The Hills of Eyes was something like that, too. And there was a shift towards almost a mythological type father figures, with the Michael Myers, the people behind the mask, and Freddy Krueger, and in a sense Jason too, where they were not really human, but some sort of almost quasi-human killing force, you know, that was completely outside morality. It's kind of a spin-off, I think, of the psychotic figure. I think part of the innovation of the Scream series, and it's, you know, it's a sort of a triptych conceived by Kevin Williamson, the writer, is that when the mask was off, it was not, you know, sort of a mythological creature like a Freddy Krueger, who was almost, was not really truly human, but it was the kid next door, your boyfriend.
Right. Wes Craven is my guest, and he's the director of, I mean, his most recent films are Scream and Scream 2. I know in the opening of Scream 2, Jada Pinkett and Omar Epps play two people who are going to the movies, they're on a date, and they're going to see a horror film called Stab. And Stab is the film version of the murders that had taken place in their town. And actually, these were the murders depicted in Scream 1. Uh-huh. And Jada Pinkett is at this horror film very reluctantly. I mean, she doesn't like horror films. She thinks they're kind of racist, too, because if there's an African-American in it, they're going to get killed off right away. But, you know, she doesn't like these horror films. And everything that's happening in the theater is really her worst nightmare. The teenagers are dressed in the masks that the killer wears in the movie. They've obviously seen the movie like dozens of times, and they're back again, and they're kind of chanting and race, and, you know, there's a lot of bloodlust in the theater.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering if you've ever seen strange reactions to your films, reactions that you might have not been very comfortable with, where the audience is getting more into the bloodlust than in identifying with the killer than the victim.
Right. I'd be a liar if I said I had not been in that situation, because I have, and when I have, it's been very disturbing, and certainly that scene was designed to reflect that, you know, to the extent it sort of says to the audience, to the extent that you're enjoying somebody suffering and dying on screen, you are out of touch with reality. And obviously that whole scene is, you know, designed to juxtapose a screen death with an actual death within the theater, and the shock of the audience when they finally realize that what they thought was a big publicity joke was an actual murder. So there is a condemnation of that reaction to that kind of film at that moment, and I think it's quite shocking. And it was a wake-up call in a way. The entire film has that theme running throughout it, the theme of, do these films encourage cause or, you know, such behavior, or do they, if nothing else, sort of trivialize suffering?
I guess as film director Wes Craven, his latest films are Scream and Scream 2. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Director Wes Craven is my guest, and his films include Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, Swamp Thing, Nightmare on Elm Street, and his latest films, Scream and Scream 2. Your first film, which was made in 1972, is called Last House on the Left. And in this movie, this is just a really mortifying movie. It's about two girls who are pursued by, you know, a group of, you know, kind of psycho, I think they're escaped convicts, actually.
Right.
If I remember correctly, I sort of
long time
ago. Yeah,
and they also have the son along, too.
Yeah, and so the girls are raped and then eviscerated by these guys, and it's shown pretty graphically on screen. And then the parents
one is.
And then the parents of the raped and eviscerated girl seek revenge against the killers and successfully seek revenge against them in very graphic ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I might have mentioned to you in an earlier interview that this is perhaps the only movie I ever walked out on because it was so... The rape and evisceration scenes were so graphic and so upsetting. I didn't want to see it. I didn't want to be in the theater for it. I didn't want these memories to be playing back in my mind.
Right.
I came back after the scene was over. Rarely does a movie upset me like that. What were your reasons then for making it so graphic? And I should say here that the movie was also so cheaply shot because it was like your first film, you had no money, that it plays back like a home movie, which makes it even more disturbing because you can't, it's harder to say, oh, it's just a Hollywood film.
Right.
Because it wasn't a Hollywood film.
No, completely not a Hollywood film. And it was the time of Vietnam War was still going full strength. And the notion was to do something that was completely anti establishment and completely non-Hollywood, and to treat violence as we both felt it really was, and we're seeing it played out in footage, video footage out of the war, which was, you know, it was incredibly personal. It had sexual overtones. It did not cut away. The victims did not often die quickly, that they quite often would beg for mercy. You know, all of those horribly unpleasant moments in actual violence. And so that was the kind of the, the premise of the movie was that it would be completely uncompromising. It would never, the lens would never move away. We also had both sort of learned the basic skills of filmmaking in a building that was almost exclusively documentary filmmakers who would often talk around, you know, the coffee pot of how they would never look away and they would never interfere if anything they saw, and they would just record it. So that was the premise, and that's kind of how it was directed. It was, the scenes were played out almost uncut. But with the evisceration, which happened to one character, not the other one was shot to death, but just for matters of accuracy, it wasn't all about that. But that was the final death, and that was the moment when the bad guys, if you will, became human, because it was they became human a moment after they became completely inhuman. And at the moment that they realized they had stabbed this girl so many times that they had eviscerated her, in the sense that, you know, there was evidence of the inside of her body on the outside, that was the point when they realized they had gone completely insane and were in a frenzy, and they fell away and they tried to wash themselves up at a local lake, and they were completely sickened by what they had done. And to me, that was the important moment, because at that moment, the film starts to turn, and these escaped convicts, who were kind of done almost as a burlesque at the beginning and got more and more real, became completely real. And then the parents, when they became aware of who these people were and what they had done to their daughter and to their daughter's friends, became just as methodical in their revenge killing as the killers had been. And so it was kind of an examination of how ordinary people can swing around and become just as, you know, bloody as people who begin as murderers.
But, you know, in the long run, it finally was being shown as an entertainment. You know, it wasn't being billed as an anti-violence movie that captures the anti-war spirit Vietnam era. You know, it's a movie that's going to play like drive-ins and horror theaters.
No film will ever be sold that way, and,
right.
And nobody who makes a film has any control over that. All you can do is control what you put into the film.
Yeah. What's the range of reactions that you've gotten to that film over the years? I shared mine. I was out in the hallway for part of it.
Yeah. Oh no, that was by far the most extreme reactions I've ever had to film. There were very, very violently, many violently angry reactions.
Mm-hmm.
I had people get up and leave the dinner table when they learned that I had made the film. I had people that no longer left their children alone with me. I mean, there was a lot of anger, especially from middle class, kind of straight people, if you will. And there was also an enormous fan reaction of, very positive. So it was very strange. And then I also had probably more than ever reactions from guys who said, oh, that was great, you know, where I sort of felt, oh, my God, I don't want to make a movie for you.
right.
And I don't think I've ever gone to that place again.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you think you could have made a movie like Last House on the Left today as a filmmaker in your 50s?
No, I don't think so. But there's many mitigating things that would keep you from doing that. For one thing, you you're smarter in the sense of where you are in a business and that you have to deal with people and try to do more films. I think that is the sort of film you can only do when you're first starting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it hurt me in many ways because it convinced a lot of people that I can only do that and that I must be some sort of Charles Manson character.
Right.
And also, it was done by two guys who were completely off the radar grid of any sort of censorship. I mean, it was submitted to the MPAA, but at the point that we couldn't get an R, we simply released it unrated, which is something that you couldn't do once you're a more high-profile director. So, it's just one of those...
How about ethically, could you have made it today?
No, ethically, I don't have any problems with it ethically because I think, it was brutally, brutally honest. I don't know whether I could be quite that brutal again or feel like it was justified doing it more than once. That's what would stop me,
mm-hmm.
just feeling like I've shown that, move on to other treatments of violence, but you don't have to be that graphic ever again.
Wes Craven. His latest films are Scream and Scream 2. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Wes Craven, director of such horror films as The Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, A Nightmare on Elm Street, and A Vampire in Brooklyn. His latest films are the box office hits Scream and Scream 2, horror films that also satirize the genre. No, I know you didn't see many movies as a kid. I think your parents were very religious.
Right.
And what were their fears about movies?
Well, I think that as much as I can put it together, because it was never expressed so much as it just was a fait accompli when, we just didn't go to movies, was that they were just too worldly, using that term that is used in that fundamentalist world, and that basically I think meant they were too sexual and too I think probably the sexuality of it more than anything else was what disturbed them, but the fact of the themes and the subjects were too risque, too sexual, too whatever for to be of any good to the mind and body, which was considered the tabernacle of the Holy Spirit. So there was kind of a panoply of things that were not done or allowed, smoking, drinking, playing cards, dancing, all of those things were forbidden. So it simply were not part of my life, and it wasn't a huge problem for me. I mean, if you're not aware of something, it's simply not there in a way. And
Where did you grow up? I mean, and how?
Cleveland, Ohio. It wasn't like I was living out in the middle of in a holy roller territory. It was just a fundamentalist Baptist church, and there were a lot of other churches that also believed the same thing. So it was, at that time, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are still churches that have those general guidelines. It just was not, something that was done. My mother was very, very involved in the church, and the church was virtually the core of our social life. We went all day Sundays and on Wednesdays for prayer meetings and church camps and church daily vacation Bible schools and everything else. It was my world until I broke out of it. So, it was just I was guided towards books and became a bookworm and got my joy of storytelling out of reading novels, basically.
Do you feel that any of your horror films have addressed your innermost fears?
No, I think they all have. I think there's a great deal in there that that has to do with that, and I know that Freddy Krueger, and this is not to be, this is the sort of thing that one's mother in Cleveland can hear by third hand and be horrified by. But I think there's a certain fear that I had for my father, for instance, that comes out in you know, in a grotesque form in like a Freddy Krueger, who is like the ultimate patriarchal nefarious character, you know, who is dangerous and takes delight in sort of scaring the younger. That not that my father chased me around with a glove full of knives, but it was just like, to me, he was a scary person. He was not around a great deal, and he had a sharp anger, a bad temper, and I remember being quite afraid of him. I'm sure I translated some of those feelings as a small child into those kinds of characters, and a lot of my films have to do with sons facing, for instance, in Shocker, you know, facing a father who was a killer and who says basically it could be the same thing. So, you know, I don't think they would be anywhere nearly as strong as they have been if they were not in some way reflecting issues that were, you know, from deep inside myself.
Speaking of Freddy Krueger, do you remember how you came up with that image of a glove full of knives?
It was a pretty methodical sort of intellectual process. I mean, I was trying to work off of primal and ancient to sort of atavistic images and themes, you know, since I figured I was dealing basically with dreams, which were some sort of primal theater, you know, some sort of brain theater, if you will, brain cinema. I was trying to go back to the very beginnings of everything. So, you know, it was the father figure, and it was the weapon was, you know, what I thought was the epitome of human ability was the hand, you know, the human hand, which is so remarkable and so far advanced from any other animals. And going back beyond that, the primal threat that I, you know, surmised must have faced primitive man was, first of all, edged and pointed weapons of tooth and fang and claw and talon, and just put that onto the attach that to that extraordinary instrument of both good and evil of the human hand.
Now, I know Scream and Scream 2 were, I think, part of a three-picture deal with Miramax, and the agreement was for one of those pictures you didn't have to do a horror film, which is, I think, something you've been waiting for a while, a chance to do something else. So tell us about what this other film, the film that's not a horror film, is going to be about.
Well, we have several things in development. The thing with the most hedonic right now is something based on a documentary that was called originally Fiddlefest, and then I think was released under the title Small Wonders. And Small Wonders, Fiddlefest, is the story of a woman who teaches, an actual living woman, Roberta Tavares, who teaches classical violin in East Harlem. And even when she went in, she was told that, you know, these kids would not be capable of learning really classical music. And the results after 14 years are that her kids have played at Carnegie Hall, and they just... She and a whole group of her students just returned from Europe, having toured in many of the royal courts and the theaters, and she's a tremendous triumph. So it's one of those wonderful stories of a woman who turned her own life around by turning the lives of students around and vice versa.
This kind of inspirational movie seems very out of character for you. What appeals to you about the story?
Well, you know, it's just that there's just huge parts of myself that have not been... you know, put into my movies except in sort of codified ways. So it represents a lot of what I'm interested in. I love classical music. I was a teacher. I taught college humanities for 5 years. I taught at high school for a year. So I love the, you know, the realm of teaching, and the idea of showing what a really good teacher can do is really exciting, and it just has a lot of things about it that I really like. So it's just one of those things that when you do horror films, people always assume that you have a very limited perspective. But myself and most of the horror film directors that I know are very broadly educated people and have a lot of other things in their life. And it just happens to be that that is what they have become famous for.
Your last couple of horror films, Scream and Scream 2, have been so successful. Do you want to use that success to keep making more horror films, or would you like to get away from the genre and do... only other things now, or mix it up?
Very much like to mix it up. I mean, I feel like, you know, I've had really an interesting career in that genre, partially from choice, partially from the fact that it was very difficult to get work outside. With the two Screams, I've had a tremendous amount of feedback now from from studios and from producers saying, you know, we can see you can do just about anything because there is comedy in there and there's real relationships and really great performances. So we're developing other projects that are, you know, out of the genre. I would like to do Scream 3 because, first of all, it was a great challenge doing a sequel that has done as well as the first one. That rarely is done.
As even your characters know how hard it is to make a good sequel.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, it's now virtually at the same mark that the first one was at. And I can't think of anybody that's done three in a row really, really well. So that's a great challenge. After that, I wouldn't mind saying goodbye forever to horror if I could. I think that would be my choice and just to go on into other sorts of films.
Thank you so much for talking with us. I should let you get back to work.
Okay, Terry.
Director Wes Craven. His latest films are Scream and Scream 2.